but for the first time ever, I cannot do this tomorrow night. Well, first time in a while. My Japanese classes start again on Wednesday. Just as Japan is, like, setting new records for COVID cases and the government is looking set to do fuck all about it.
Well, I mean, they thought the Olympics were still going to be going ahead at one point, so...
Player 2 Pixelcast episode 39 is coming, guys. Our podcast is almost middle age. We're around the corner from 40. I don't know if I should be proud or depressed. I guess I'm going to leave that decision up to Steven. Should we be proud or depressed about the number?
I mean, with age comes wisdom.
The age. Yeah. Although I also think I forgot to introduce myself again, so with age also comes dementia.
This is
my name's Tim. Hi.
Tim, people. He's yes.
He's supposed to be hosting this thing.
Sharp as attack.
Howdy, Tim.
Sharp as attack that has been trodden on and hurt somebody's foot badly. Sean, are you sharp as attack?
Yes.
Or were you attacked by attack? Or why are we talking about attacks?
Oh, look, I'm feeling slightly depressed, you know, with your whole jive about getting to middle age, because, you know, I'm at 38, I'm right on the cusp, man. So I'd like to think I'm still sharp, but, you know, feeling it in the bones a little bit.
That's the worst place to feel it. Those are the things that crack and break, dude. Meanwhile, our editor is not going to be joining us because he hurt himself because he had, and I quote, a fall.
I mean, what can we say? Matt, please, look after yourself.
Just sit on the couch, get a game controller, open some beers. Which will probably may be responsible for falling over, actually. That would make a lot of sense.
We need our illustrious leader. We cannot lose him.
Who else is going to write you know, lovely podcast intros for all of us week after week?
He does put a lot of effort. He does put more effort into the podcast intros than anybody else. But if you're wondering why we are, like, starting off so depressing, it's because this episode is going to be very heavily leaning into The Last of Us Part 2. We've all played it through now, and so we're going to dedicate the second half of this show to just giving our, like, actual final thoughts and feelings without any need to feel like we have to not say certain things to protect people from being spoiled. But before that, it turns out we have been playing some other games. I'm going to start with a big one. Sean, you've put at least a little bit of time into that there very Western-looking samurai game.
Oh, yeah. Ghost of Tsushima. Actually, when I first fired it up and heard him speaking, I finally learned how to pronounce it properly. I've been loving it. Everybody, I'm sure, has seen the pictures that are floating around on Twitter from people sharing from their PS4s.
Yeah, it seems that photo mode is something else.
It is a gorgeous game. And it's one of those ones where you just get lost in wandering around, just taking in the beauty of it. I suck at the combat at the moment. I'm very much, if I am taking on any more than two guys at a time, I will get owned very badly and very quickly. And especially in some of the boss fights where I'm like, yeah, I'm ready to parry this dude, and all of a sudden they just cleave me straight through and I'm dead. But aside from my lack of combat skills, the straight up combat, sneaking around, stabbing him from behind, very Assassin's Creed-y, as Paul mentioned in his player two plays. I'm just really digging the whole vibe of the game so far, and, enjoying, I haven't done much of the actual main story missions. I've more just been, oh, hang on, there's a little dojo there. I'm gonna free that and take out the leader and learn a new stance, or, you know, the Tails side quest that he's got. I just got myself a wicked set of armor, so it's very cool. So much to just do and just wander around finding things. And I was actually thrown a little bit when it asked me to, you know, make a haiku, and I'm like, is this gonna fail out on me? Because I have no idea how to make a haiku. So, but thankfully it let me go and just sent me on my merry way. So yeah, loving it so far and going to be putting a few more hours into it, that's for sure.
You do seem to be describing an open world ass open world game.
Oh yes.
Yeah, it's...
I guess I am.
It's definitely not like a massive step forward for the genre. It's just like refined to the nth degree in a lot of ways.
I think a part of what endears it to a lot of people as well is, I mean, how many people have been clamoring for an Assassin's Creed game set in Japan?
Yeah, people have been wanting that for about a decade now.
Yeah, now everybody would have assumed, oh yeah, ninjas and whatever, because it's the perfect, you know, fit for that series. But this works even as a samurai. I mean, he's bending his code, in his own words, to, you know, embrace assassination moves and not looking someone in the eye when he slits their throat. So I think, you know, Ubisoft just don't seem to want to listen to people when it comes to that and keep coming up with all these different different settings, yes, different settings and time frames than that feudal Japan. And this is, you know, it's a very nice substitute for that setting.
I wonder if it's not just them staying a little bit Eurocentric as well, given that Ubisoft is like a French company. Outside of Origins, you know, pretty much everything is, you know, heavily European.
A lot of them have taken place in Europe.
And it could just be, maybe that's why they haven't wanted to go in that direction. But you're absolutely right. Like, I think it's been one of the most requested settings of the Assassin's Creed series. So this is going to fill that gap for a lot of people.
Definitely.
To a degree, I have heard that the enemy AI is not super great. Oh, it's
pretty dumb. I'm playing on normal, and having finished Sekiro, the combat is not overly challenging. In a lot of ways, sometimes the biggest enemy is the camera, because not only is there no lock on, but it doesn't sort of auto-correct itself. So sometimes if there's a fair few enemies and you're rolling around, because the roll button is the circle button, you have to take your hand off the right thumbstick to be able to roll. So it's hard to, you know, maintain the camera and roll at the same time without a lock on. Whereas, you know, most of your FromSoft games, you can lock on, roll around, and you still maintain that camera on the enemy. This doesn't have that. So maybe if I looked into it and could remap that button to something else. But yeah, dodging and rolling is the circle button. I don't know about most people, but I can't press the circle button and control the right stick at the same time. So
grow an extra thumb, dude. Grow an extra thumb.
Sometimes the camera gets a bit wonky, but I think there are a lot of things in there that help mitigate some of the difficulty in the combat. And it's trying to get you to not embrace that ghost play style too early. It wants you to have that sort of internal struggle that's going on for the protagonist, where he does not want to sort of dishonor his samurai heritage. But the fact of the matter is, much like Sekiro, the stealth gameplay is just piss easy compared to every other part of the combat in a lot of ways. So I've been doing a lot of ghost stuff and, you know, mixing it up a little bit with standoffs and other things, but yeah, I'm not finding it overly tough.
Well, that standoff system sounds kind of fascinating, actually.
It's actually, I love doing it. Every time I get the opportunity to do a standoff, it could just be I come across three random dudes in the forest. Oh, standoff, yep, yes! And then just, you know, you just feel like the ultimate badass.
So how exactly does it work?
Essentially, you're calling them out as a samurai, and you and one dude will square off with one another, and you basically just hold triangle until they go to make their attack, and then you'll just do one of those classic samurai one move, swish with the sword, instant kill. You can upgrade it so that you're then able to follow on, you know, up to two other people as well. But I noticed, like, in the early part of the game, it was just a matter of just holding it, wait until you see them start to move, and then boom, done. I've just hit a point where out of nowhere it pops up with watch out for a feint, because sometimes they're going to try and trick you. And it seems I haven't mastered that yet, because every time I'm in a standoff now, I'll let it go too early, and they end up just taking out a massive chunk of your life, and you're pretty much, I'm just ready to give up.
If you don't have any health in reserve, it's a big penalty for messing up a standoff.
Mm.
Well, that would be thematically appropriate with the huge risk reward dice roll kind of.
Once I play it a bit more, I reckon I'll probably get the hang of it a bit better. I'm just too quick to let go of that attack button as soon as I see him start to flinch. I've just got to train myself out of that. Wait for them to be sure that they're actually making a move, and just developing my skills as a fighter.
Just getting pump faked too much, man.
I think I'm going to take.
Do you feel like?
I think I'm going to take my time with it, just because. As Paul mentioned in some of his review, there are parts of it that are fairly repetitive, and I've found that Mafia 3 being a big example of an open world game where I loved so much about the story and just all those repetitive elements. I dropped off that game
because it was just too much stuffing that wasn't interesting at all.
And the other problem is with all of these games putting in like RPG light systems, then you feel compelled to do all of that stuff because you get, you know, your little meters filling up and you get to unlock more things and it gets you to, you know, that next skill unlock that you want to get that much quicker, but it can mean that you burn out really quickly on certain elements of the game. So I think I'm gonna slow burn this one, unlike The Last of Us Part 2, which I smashed out over a weekend.
Holy crap, that's fast for that game, which we'll get into in a bit. I guess another thing I want to know in your thoughts regarding that then, do you feel like this is just like a very polished groundwork for which we're going to see a spectacularly designed sequel in the PS5?
Yep. That's the vibe I get.
That was a pretty...
I mean, you look at how gangbusters it's gone already. It's already immensely popular. I think they'll probably take on board a lot of what people are saying. And
the thought is, once they've got the groundwork down, they'll be able to actually do some great game design stuff and not have to worry.
Well, look back at Sucker Punch's history. Infamous, the original Infamous, had a whole bunch of problems, and some would say even the same sort of issues that this game has. And then they went back, they tweaked the way they had the missions and the side missions and whatever working. And when Infamous 2 came out, that was, as far to my understanding, a critical success. So, I mean, they're the sort of guys that do seem to be able to learn from their.
I wouldn't say most studios are. It just feels like this game in particular seems like it's a groundwork for which they're going to build on.
It kind of feels, and I've seen this mentioned quite a bit, like it feels right for an Assassin's Creed 2, like that. Jump where you got the first game where, you know, there's a lot of promise here. It's quite good, it's but you comparison. Can see where it could be improved. And I think a lot of people sort of pointed out the same for Spider-Man. I think that's, you know, for a lot of open world games, what we're finding in the first entry is a lot of promise. It doesn't hit every mark, but once they refine that for the sequel, they can take it to that next level. We were talking about Watch Dogs earlier. I think Watch Dogs 2 was a game that for a lot of people really... you know, fulfilled a lot of the promises that first game showed. And I think...
And how about Watch Dogs 3? Honestly, we don't know. Maybe there will be a thing where it shows up by the time you send this. Maybe not. Screw that. Catherine. You've been playing Catherine. I remember this game being super cool.
Yeah, it's still super cool. If you...
The Switch version, correct?
Yeah, on the Switch, the full body edition, which has some more story content and... wider range of difficulty levels and a few other bells and whistles to it. So it's you know, very similar to the original PS3 and 360 release in a lot of ways. I'm not super far into it. We should probably explain a little bit. And it's been so many years since the PS3 release that I can't remember too much about the game. So I'm slowly, you know, sort of making my way through it. But the gameplay is as enjoyable as I remember. But again, if you're not a huge puzzle game fan, don't let the Persona visuals draw you in and fool you. It's not what you're going to get out of Catherine at all.
I'm not a huge puzzle game fan. I still freaking love that. And like, from, I guess we established what this actually is you're kind of just playing this 30-something guy who's just kind of kicking the tires of life.
Yeah, he's pretty much like he's a commitment phobe, and he's sort of at a crossroads in his life where he has to decide if he's going to knuckle down and, you know, really get serious with his girlfriend and take the next step into, you know, marriage and potentially children, all those other things. And he's, yeah, kind of, I guess, having some existential dread about that. And then he gets involved with his girlfriend is another Catherine girl. With a K, and then he gets involved with the titular character, Catherine with a C.
Catherine with a C.
And there's a lot of supernatural spookiness happening as well in terms of the nightmare dreamscape he's entering, which provides the...
Which is where the puzzles... And it's just climbing over blocks.
Yeah, climbing up. They're block puzzles. Like, it's... And it does get more complicated than that in later sections from memory. But essentially, if you... I think there's a demo available, so I'd suggest people try that out, because given that a lot of people have jumped on that Persona 5 bandwagon, and this was, you know, even on the PS3 era, after Persona 4 pretty heavily touted as, you know, from the Persona team and, you know, mature storytelling and other things like that, it doesn't play anything like a Persona game. It sort of looks like one, though. In fact, I've heard that Catherine was them sort of playing around with their new engine to get ready for Persona 5 in a lot of ways. So it's kind of interesting that this has got a re-release in the wake of, you know, the continued ongoing success of the Persona series. But grab a demo and see if the game plays for you, because the storyline is probably not going to carry you over if you don't dig it.
Same thing. Although, having said that, if you want pure just puzzles, it's also not that. Because the story is more than window dressing.
Yeah, it's fairly involved, and you do, you know, it's got a lot of visual novel elements, so if that's something that doesn't really gel with you, then, you know, if visual novels and, you know, block puzzles are instantly ringing alarm bells for you, check out a demo.
Yeah, maybe don't go there, actually.
But...
You could just sit back and have a coup de libre instead, because you have a lot of those in that game from memory.
Yes. But again, it's, you know, somewhat more on the mature side, and the story's not going to grab everybody. And, you know... My understanding is that there are some problematic elements in terms of representations of particular characters in there, which seems to have been exacerbated by some of the changes and additions to this full body version. I haven't reached any of those points in the story yet, so I can't comment aside from what I've heard online and from other people. But I'll just spend a bit more time on it. And at this point, you know, I was a fan on the PS3. That's why I put my hand up for the review. But that was however many years ago.
I played that in like 2011, 2012 or something. So.
I think it was around the time I started writing for Player 2. It wasn't long after.
May have been earlier.
Yeah, it may have even been earlier. So pretty old. And I guess, you know, the Switch is probably a really good place for this scope of game, to be honest. Like the PS4 or the Xbox One... It's not going to super impress. It does feel really limited in scope in a lot of ways, but probably a lovely game to have on the Switch for what it offers.
I think a Switch, it would switch between handheld. I think being a puzzle game, like it's probably
it suits that
switch
short
between big and
burst
small screen.
Play. Yeah, like you can do a few levels in your 20 or 30 minute commute, and then, or however long your commute is, and then switch it off, and you know. It probably serves
and
that a bit better than...
Get back to it when you feel like it. You get to play it on your own time. Like, anyway, you know, speaking of games that are maybe not exactly what you're expecting, and also happen to just be, like, a woman's name. Last night, my girlfriend and I play/watched Erica.
Oh, I have bought that, but I have not touched it because it piqued my interest... you know, a lot of those sort of FMV games that have been coming out recently, the more, you know, high tier ones like, Her Story and, things like that. So it looked interesting, but I'm keen to hear what you, have to say about it.
Yeah. So I wasn't that interested. It was a PS Plus game. And I was like, you know what? This actually seems curious. I think my girlfriend may be like fascinated to find out this is somehow interactive. And I hadn't looked more... hugely looks past it other than like a quick search to see people seem to think it's maybe not amazing but like actually still pretty good, so we'll give it a go. way more interactive than I was expecting, and probably for the worst. So I kind of was going in thinking, actually, I still haven't played that Black Mirror episode on Netflix either, but I was expecting kind of a choose your own adventure kind of thing, and maybe there'd be like 5 or 6 key points in the story where it'd be like, okay, do you trust this person? Do you not trust this person? Do you want her to stand and fight? Do you want her to run away? There's really not a whole lot like that. There's a whole lot of using both of your fingers on either your phone or the touchpad part of the PS4 controller to like draw curtains or like open stuff up. Or, like, flick open a cigarette lighter. Or, like, flip through files. There's a lot of, like, really menial stuff that makes it actually feel like those kind of budgety-ish point-and-click adventure games of, like, the late CD-ROM era. And it's really jarring because, like, it's a disembodied thing, so the interactive stuff like that is obviously trying to look realistic, but it's actually CG. And it just breaks up the pacing in what is still very much a movie.
That sounds kind of super cheesy.
I mean, it's very forced. And I'm wondering, like, after we finished it and my girlfriend immediately went and looked up on YouTube every possible ending.
How long was the playthrough?
It was movie length, but it'd be a short movie.
Like 90 minutes or something?
Probably 90 minutes, maybe a little bit less from... I wasn't really paying that much attention to the clock, but it definitely was not like a 2.5 hour extravaganza. It's more on the horror theme. You're like this young girl whose mother like passed away. She used to work for a psych ward, and you're like going back there trying to figure out what happened on, and then you start discovering all these, or she starts discovering all these things. And I'm saying you because it is more interactive than it really should be. But like the number of things that actually matter that you do, I feel like there's probably only like maybe 4. Like, when I said earlier, like, I was expecting 4 or 5 big decisions. That's, at most, I think, what this game/movie actually has.
Did those decisions feel like it changed the story in any meaningful way?
I mean, I guess mild spoiler here, but I don't think it's important enough. There's one point where if you have to have remembered the name of a medicine that will either wake up or kill a person, so that would probably change it. In a meaningful way, so that'd be...
I guess it sounds kind of like it's riffing on some of those, like...
But the endings all seem to...
Things?
Yeah, the endings all... Oh, no, Until Dawn is better than this. I think it's actually... A lot of the interaction, I guess, is best described... It's very David Cage. The difference is because it's, like, in a movie and it's, like, it's still a set pace, like... David Cage games always eventually go off the rails, but I have this point early on where, like, it's actually just nice being in his world that's kind of... cool doing this menial stuff, and that works because you're controlling the character and you're not immediately moving a plot forward, you're just taking time to be. That doesn't work quite as well when it's video scenes stitched together.
So yeah, it sounds like some of those really early FMV games.
Just much, much higher production values, yeah.
Oh, that's a bummer.
It is really interesting and kind of like the beer is drinking with it. It would be better if it was actually less interesting.
So a little bit more streamlined, a little bit more standard than...
Like, they need to maybe put more work into, like, really branching that narrative and less into just novelty. Let's remind you that this is interactive, because, hey, I actually want to sit back and eat my popcorn for a bit, and then occasionally have to press a button. So if you really think it's interesting, sure, but I generally talk about stuff I like on this, but in this case, I'm like, download it because it's on PS Plus and it's free if you've already paid for the subscription. But if there's something that you want to see that's on your Netflix backlog, maybe just watch that instead.
Maybe go and watch that Black Mirror episode.
Yeah, for example. Anyway, we're going to take a break there. And when we come back, we'll be talking about a game that I presume we all liked more than I liked this movie-like thing. And was also more successfully cinematic, actually. We'll be back in 1 minute. Hey, we're back, and all three of us have survived the apocalypse, and on that note, we have also finished The Last of Us 2. As I mentioned at the start of the show, we are basically saying whatever the heck we feel about this game now. We're not explicitly going to talk our way through the story spoiler-wise, but we are going to be completely unfiltered. So if you're yet to play this and do not want anything spoiled, don't wait for a spoiler warning, just maybe turn this off now.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks. Yeah. Bye. You can find us at pixplay2.net.au. Hey, look at that. I remembered to pimp something. Anyway, Steve, you seem to want to know what everybody else wanted to know, so now I want to know what you wanted to get off your chest.
Oh, my lord. So, lots...
What's your overall... How did you feel when you finished the game?
Relief and regret and a whole bunch of mixed emotions that took me a little while to sort through, and I think I initially had no desire to go back and play that game ever again. There were so many parts of it that once I got through, and I think that's on purpose, once I got through, I was like, I would really never need to play that again. It's similar, I don't know if anyone out there has seen the film Mother by Darren Aronofsky, but that is like a piece of cinema.
Is that based off a Korean movie that's... Is it based off a Korean movie? There was a Korean movie called Mother about 10 years ago that was super dark in its own way.
Well, this is super dark, and it's the kind of thing where I went and saw it in the cinema, and it was all, like, unsettling for most of it and horrifying for some of it, and the kind of thing where I saw it, and I was like, that was a fantastic film, and I never want to watch it ever again. And that was pretty much how I felt coming out of this game. But upon reflection and starting to, you know, poke around my own thoughts a little bit and... You know, I guess what would the word be? Just revisit some of the earlier segments of the game in my mind. I was like, you know what? I think I could probably go through this again, even if I don't finish it, but just to, you know, see how it holds up, especially some of the structural elements that I don't necessarily agree with. But I would like to see if I could rejig those... by through chapter select or something and see if that ends up being something more palatable. And yeah, like I think it's just such a phenomenal experience in a lot of ways and not what I was really expecting in a lot of others. Especially having come off the back of, I just recently replayed the first game and that sort of reinforced to me the idea that it was a game that I never needed a sequel to. But I'm glad that they made one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people still divide on that. I was definitely not a fan of Joel's actions at the end of the first game.
I think this is important.
And this one is obsessed with that. Like, its very core is, like...
Well...
Dealing with the results
of
that.
Yeah, it's I guess it's sort of the ripple effect of his actions in the first game that lead to everything that happens in the second game. I'm interested to see how old were we all when we played the first game initially? I was 26 or 27.
When was it 2013? I would have just hit my 30s, probably.
Because what I've noticed in a...
Yeah, 31.
Sorry, Sean, you were...
31.
So what I've noticed in a lot of the criticism, at least, or I've inferred from what I've seen, is that I get the idea that a lot of the people that were horrified with the death of Joel were probably a bit too young to have been playing this game when they did, or were very much in sort of the late teens and didn't necessarily have the ability to really fully comprehend everything that was going on in that story. And I'm not saying that it's a complex story, because it's not, but I think a lot of what it trades in is ideas and emotions and things that you wouldn't necessarily have experienced or have parallels to unless you've gone through certain life experiences. Yes, it's got a lot of the sad dad tropes in it, but I mean, so much of the ending of that game and his decision is his selfishness and his inability to let really have ever let go of his daughter. Like, that's essentially what that whole game is. It's, you know, however many years later after that event, he has still not actually put that to rest, and Ellie becomes a surrogate daughter.
It's fascinating how much this part, because Ellie's character just becomes increasingly broken over the course of The Last of Us 2, and it has to start with when you eventually get the flashback and she kind of learns that, oh, shit.
Well, that's the...
Like, I could have been a vaccine, and that, well, fun, that means I'm dead.
But she was it's cool like, with that?
She never got a say in it. Yeah. But, well, I don't think... I think she kind of made herself be cooled with that because all she had left was Joel, so it struck me as this kind of a Stockholm syndrome.
And that's where I think it's really, like, that's the beauty of it. When you start to think about these as, you know, actual fleshed-out characters with their own motivations and their own sort of experiences and their own agency up to a degree, when that's sort of taken from them or subverted, that's where it really starts to get interesting. The idea that, and again, the way you read the end of that first game can be totally different. Some people took it as, oh no, Ellie totally believes everything that Joel tells her. I took it as she knows he's full of shit, or at least suspects he is to a degree, but she's cool with it for now. Like, I will accept what you've said at face value for now, but I kind of think you're full of shit.
Yeah, I don't think I went as far as cool as shit, but I think she made a conscious choice to trust him. And kind of blanked out. And, like, just told herself, I will believe him.
But then, obviously, there was that... We see in the second game...
She didn't know, but, like, it was a very thin layer that could be broken.
Yeah, we see in that second game that clearly there was something that was niggling her and just never quite sat right. And that festered over time until the eventual revelation of, you know, he killed everyone who would have been able to utilize, you know, her immunity to...
Because it wasn't just, like, he took away the potential...
No, it's not like, oh, we've just got
whatever. Maybe Ellie would have been, but, like, he literally murdered, like, an entire, like, the last gathering of doctors.
Well, yeah, like, it's inferred that the last people that they, and, you know, set of facilities that, you know, could have, you know, generated a potential vaccine out of that. And not only that, sort of played it off that she was not unique in any way. There'd been tons of people and none of them had yielded anything.
Yeah, it's... I don't know, like, it... My main issue with it, scene where, again, Abby kills Joel, is that, my God, that looked painful.
I
don't deal well with knees, and, like, she just blew his kneecap, like, straight off.
And I think it was that brutality being reframed when you're suddenly not the person controlling that happening. Like, how many people's legs did you blow off with a shotgun as Joel? How many people did you beat to death? Like, how much violence have you committed in, you know, service of your own desires? And it's uncomfortable to see someone else do the same thing.
Well, that's the whole point of having you play as Abby, I guess. It's maybe spending a bit too much time. The thing is, I don't think there's any part of this game that is poorly designed, but I do feel like it is too long.
One of the interesting things that I heard was...
And I don't know what I would take out. I do not know which part I would extract.
I've got a few ideas of things that I think I would take in. I'll run through a few in a second. But one of the things I heard on a podcast was they're interviewing Neil Druckmann, and he said, had the game been delayed more, it would be shorter.
We had this comment last episode as well.
Again, I think the idea, like, they were getting to the point where they were just going to start paring things back a bit more. So
yeah, because I feel like if that thing had been 4 or 5 hours shorter, it would have been just spot on.
And I like one that I can think of is like the ship when you're Abby towards the very tail end of the game, leading up to going back to the aquarium. That section felt a little bit needless. I would say going through the collapsing building as Abby and Lev felt a little bit...
See, this is where my issue is, because I think my favorite part of that game was the Abby-Lev
adventure.
And
that's what I mean. Like,
but a part of me is also, like, this is a, like, key, and I said this last episode as well, it's like, it's a key kill your darlings thing, because I think this is my favorite part of the game, but it may also be one of the bits that's a little bit too long.
And that's where it's, like, fact, I'm conflicted on that, because that, I felt, went for too long, but I guess it's also...
That section by itself was also... It was just so good. I also had my favorite little bit. It had the only moment of humor in that entire game, and it worked. I feel like that game actually could have used a bit more humor in its world outside of a couple of bad jokes being cracked by Ellie and Joel. was, and the reason this worked was because it is not at all funny for the characters involved, but it is funny for you, the person watching in the distance, which was simply when Levy, I'm mixing two names together there, Abby is like kind of like walking over the entire fucking city and just freaking out because we've got this established fear of heights. And then Lev just decides to take that moment to start like teasing her about a possible boyfriend.
Or, you know, what's the deal?
And she's
with
just
you
like,
and,
no, yeah, just fucking shut up.
What's the deal with you and Owen? Seems kind of awkward. Like,
yeah.
Clearly.
And he's like just legitimately just like naive about it as well, which is what makes it even better.
What about you, Sean? Like, where do you fall on it?
I read in, just on that bit there, I read it as Lev was just trying to distract her from the height. Whether that means anything or not, I don't know. Anyway,
it didn't work, if that's the case.
I definitely agree that it was too long. When I was playing it, the game could have ended at the point where Abby's tracked down Ellie. You know, Jesse's dead. Tommy's injured. They have their fight and whatever. And Abby's like, I see you again, I kill you. Like, to me, the game could have ended there and I would have been happy. Because, I mean, yes, Joel was a big part of Ellie's life, although through the flashbacks, it sort of establishes that they were, for the most part, estranged.
Well, I think that's the tragedy they were going for, is that their last time they spoke, they did not part on good terms.
Or it was they were just about to start sort of trying to work through.
They were at the point where they were actually, yeah, that's actually it. Yeah, they were at the point where it was like, okay, let's try and make this work.
Yeah, well, like for me, it could have been a moment where Ellie's then gone, well, hang on, I've just killed how many people because they killed this one. I've been beaten and now's the time to, you know, and I've been given the chance to live. You know, to me, like I said, they could have ended it right there and I would have been happy. You know, she went off, lived with Dina and raised the baby and everything. And like it just... that whole section down in Santa Barbara, just, I don't know. I was just plodding through it going, come on, it's got to be over.
I think that section was actually really good. Its problem was the game was too long until that point, so people were ready for it to be over.
I think the reason that section is so important is because of...
it shows how broken it is.
Where each of the characters are on their individual journey in terms of revenge and the futility of it. So if we turn the tables and, you know, Abby's about to kill Joel and then Tommy or Ellie is able to, you know, prevent that from happening and they kick the shit out of her and tell her to go on her merry way, and if they ever see her again, she's going to murder, like, they'll murder her. I think it would be the same thing. She would go away and just that wound would fester because her issue is not resolved. Like, and until it is, she would just keep coming back. And I guess that's the idea, that the only way you could, you know, be 100% done with it is to completely eliminate that other person. Like, well, it didn't matter how things changed for Abby's situation. Until Joel was dead, she was never going to feel like things were square. And I think...
which is weird.
With Ellie, she, you know, obviously by that point, Abby's gone through that whole thing and she's now realized, like, okay, I went and I killed that dude and I made all my friends come with me and I don't feel
any
better.
Look what happened.
I still feel empty and unfulfilled, and Ellie has not reached that point yet, and she needs to, I guess, flagellate herself a little bit more to realize, you know, what she is giving up in service of something that is ultimately not going to fulfill what she's looking for. Killing Abby is not going to bring Joel back.
Well, I mean, we should go without saying this. Weird, the one of the notes I've got here is, like, clearly, like, this apocalypse, post-apocalypse world is in desperate need of therapists.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, it is one of the things that, like, really struck me. It's like, it's why I think you actually have that whole section playing as Abby. It's one thing to, like, oh yeah, I know there's another side to the story. It's another thing to, like, play it in that much. I really have a lot more empathy for Abby, actually, than Ellie overall by the end of this game. But it's, like, fascinating thing, because, like, just the small details, like, how thin Ellie was, and you could, like, just sense everything that was just kind of broken inside her, and that she had gotten away with things and actually had what was, within that world, an okay life.
Well, what's
she was living the close...
What's Abby's line? Hmm? You know, we let you live and you wasted it.
We let you live and you wasted it. Which is actually a very good line. And then, yeah, Ellie still gets the closest thing you could reasonably expect for a happily ever after.
And again...
And she still just kind of can't sleep. Because there's no, like, there's nobody who knows how to, like, talk her through this and how to deal this with her. And all she knows, the only thing she knows how to do is violence.
And I think that a lot of that does tie back into, you know, her final interactions with Joel, which just makes it, you know, that much worse for her, because there was that, you know, pinprick of hope that they might be able to get some sort of relationship happening between them. But obviously, like, that has been taken away forcibly from her. And that, I think that is another thing that would sort of be keeping her up at night, like the what if. Like, if things had been patched up and then Joel was murdered, I think she'd be sad, but she's like, you know what, at least we buried the hatchet and we put that other stuff behind us. But to have that taken away from her, I think, is a massively, a massive driving force behind her actions, because she's just lashing out. You have to imagine that to some degree, once she understands why Abby did what she did, it's, you know... By following Ellie's own, following Ellie's own thought process, it makes sense. Like, oh yeah, okay, cool. So he murdered your dad, and you know, completely shattered your world.
Like, not just like she was a firefly; it was like her whole world was shattered. Like, not only was her dad murdered, but she would have had a better understanding than most people of just how devastating this action was to people. At large, I just want to randomly note, actually, just the way the game plays out, I absolutely murdered the ever-loving shit out of Ellie during that first boss fight.
wasn't that, like, a weird disconnect as well? Like, and I think that's one of the things that people have trouble with this game. Like, you don't have any story agency. Naughty Dog is telling you a story and you're along for the ride. So when you get to those particular moments, that's where it starts to feel a bit janky. Like, oh, no, you
Oh, I tried to not do a thing once.
But you can't not. It's like that point of, if you don't do what we want you to do, we're just going to give you a... You know, it's just going to keep looping through these animations.
It made it feel... It did make it feel a little bit too hard, like they were trying to make you feel bad. Sometimes. But also, one of the things I think this game needs is a lower body count. Like, you do... Because you murder so many nameless guys, and then you hear their name get yelled out, and then I guess they're not nameless anymore. So many times that it kind of takes the impact away a little bit. But with regard to that specifically, it's just that when I think it just gets taken out of punches, but it's like Ellie was laying a mine. I didn't realize she was laying mines until I threw a bottle at her to stun her and then blew the mine up in her face.
And that's when you have to...
So technically, I murdered the ever-loving shit out of Ellie. It's just that the game storytelling would not let it happen, but she was in pieces. If the way I played that through went to the end, Ellie was just pieces all over the room.
And it's those disconnects. It's like the Final Fantasy issue of Phoenix Downs not working in a cutscene.
Yeah. Except it's ramped up way more, because this is a lot more... It's going so much harder into being serious and not having any sense of humor. Yeah.
I mean, how did we all feel at that shift, that you know, the 12 to 15 hours in where you pivoted to Abby?
I was like, I was like, because you played as Abby very briefly early on, it's like, I see what they're doing. Like, immediately I know exactly what they're doing. They're going straight up for the empathy drive. And what I did not expect was how fond I would actually find myself feeling of Abby regarding, as opposed to Ellie. And how cool it was, like, seeing these other ways the world had kind of been organized. And, like, the way that society was rebuilding itself in different ways. And I definitely did not expect myself to like Lev as much as I did. Sean is oddly silent.
He's collecting his thoughts, I can see it.
Exactly. Exactly.
My initial reaction was, I don't want to fucking play as this person. Like, and again, it could be that I played it over such a short period of time, and had I spaced out a bit more, maybe it would have been a bit cooler. But I just didn't want that experience.
I was actually much more gameplay minded about it. I was like, oh man, I've just spent so much time being very careful with, and to their credit, they were very sensible and kept their character customization and shit like actually quite simple. Yeah. They did not fall down to make this an RPG hole at all. But I was also like a little bit like, oh man, I don't want to go around searching for stuff and respecking all over again.
I don't have to craft shivs.
But I did actually, I mean, you almost never do though. The thing I actually did appreciate, and it's not immediately apparent, but they totally, so Ellie's quite a small, nimble girl who is also immune to being bitten. And it's not something you notice as you start playing as Abby, is that she could just straight up sneak up behind the infected and like cover their mouths and take them out. Which is basically a superpower, because if she gets, like, if they manage to bite her hand, it's probably going to fucking hurt. But it's not, well, that's everything over. So with Elliot, it really did legitimately feel much more built for stealth, whereas with Abby, it seems like it was intentionally designed to be a lot more brutal in a lot of places, and like straight up like fist fights. And like, for example, Ellie makes mines and Abby makes pipe bombs.
Pipe bombs, yeah.
I guess it's...
It was a much more aggressive
and a lot less baiting.
It was like playing as Joel in the first game. And when you do have the switch to Ellie in that game, it's, you know, immediately apparent how the shift in size and body weight and all of that stuff would have an impact on how you would have to try to survive in this world.
And the thing was neither one felt more powerful than the other in the great scheme of things. I think especially skip to the very, very end where you've got Ellie and Abby fist fighting. Keep in mind, like, Ellie's been like stabbed through the gut with like a tree branch and heaven knows what else, but Abby's being like crucified basically. But even with that, I still don't see how, even with a knife, Ellie would in close quarters stand a remote chance.
I think there's a pretty big time jump between those points, and I think it's heavily implied that Abby has been doing slave labor in this camp for quite a while, and is, you know, extremely malnourished compared to how she was when she was with
us. And Abby was literally stabbed through the entirety of her torso with a tree like 2 hours beforehand. Like,
oh, pish posh, you can walk that off. But I think that's what was heavily implied, the idea that like quite a bit of time had passed, and, you know,
it had, but she Abby still would have, she still had a physical power advantage. Oh, she was. I have to say that Naughty Dog really, really wanted to twist that knife on a couple of occasions right at the end. So you get the almost happy ending for Abby, where you actually get into contact with the Fireflies, and it turns out this wives' tale, whatever, is actually maybe true. And they literally let that go, and then you step outside and just a bunch of sadistic motorcycle gangers, whatever, like, kind of, yeah, just smack you up, and then... means that inadvertently, on her revenge quest, Ellie ends up freeing a slave camp.
Which is secondary to her goal.
Yeah, but she accidentally did a good thing. And then with Ellie, and this one is very intentional, and when my girlfriend went back and watched the intro and like actually understood the significance of it, started crying. I don't know if she wants me saying that in a podcast, but I guess I just did. Was like very specifically having Abby like just destroy two of Ellie's fingers, like almost biting them off to the point where they then had to be cut off. And she gets home, and obviously Dan has just left. Or Dina, or whatever her name is. And she tries to pick up the guitar. And she cannot play the chords anymore, and it's like, oh, this is just so set up to be as tragic as it possibly can be.
I've read and listened to a couple of ideas around that scenario, and, you know, one is that Ellie has already returned to Jackson and is, you know, potentially living with Dina again, but this is her just going to, you know, well, I'll go and grab my stuff from the farmhouse and then come back. But upon looking at it, she realizes that she's not that person anymore, and, you know, has to let things go because of her choices. So one of them being, you know, she's finally at peace with where things finished off with her and Joel, and she is letting go of that last link to him in terms of the guitar.
I did not get that remotely at all.
I basically took it as in her quest for getting that revenge, losing those fingers and losing the ability to play that guitar anymore. That was the last connection she had with Joel.
No, that was like the breaking point. Like, she has nothing left anymore.
Oh, and I guess that's one of their ideas, is that revenge can cost you everything up to a point.
Yeah.
Also, the revised title screen is the boat pulled up on Catalina Island, suggesting that Abby and Lev did make it to the Firefly camp.
Yeah. I actually think they do. I would be very interested to play a Last of Us 3 where you get to play as Lev. And also, since he is so badass with the bow and arrow, I want Platinum to make it. Also, you'd be Lev and you're a freaking badass with the bat. It's the most off-brand possible Last of Us 3. Just hammer that A button, just shoot perfect headshot arrows all over the place.
You want like a Metal Gear Revengeance, but with Lev?
Yeah, Metal Gear Revengeance is pretty fucking good. And then, yeah, like the ending can take place on like a gridiron field and shit, I don't know.
I mean, I think...
Alright, clearly I don't want that, but it the thought entertains me.
I think this is a very ambitious game in a lot of ways, and a lot of other people will poo-poo that and say, oh, well, clearly you don't play enough indie games. Guess what?
No, I don't think anybody's going to say this is not ambitious.
Oh, they will. And then once you contextualize it with for a AAA game, they'll say, oh yes, carry on. Yeah, I went to film school and I know what it's like to be a obnoxious prick as well. And then you get over it, or you're supposed to at a point. Anyway, and I think it's trying to push the envelope in particular ways. Obviously, in terms of motion capture and character performance, it's leagues above just about anything else.
It's ridiculous. I started playing Control. Granted, the PS4 Pro version, not the PC version after this. And it's not until you play another AAA game that you really appreciate the full level of detail in how good this game looks. And specifically, and you're talking about animation, that's the thing. I'm thinking, all right, I bet the PC version of Control looks way better. But it would look way better in that it would be, like, way sharper, and you'd get the 60 frames instead of the 30, and you'd get all the fancy lighting. But, man, that animation. Like, just a lot of the artistry in those visuals is just second to none.
And that's been one of the things that I've found... I really feel for Sucker Punch having to go after The Last of Us 2. Like, I think the release of those two games probably should have been flipped, because I think things that are sort of standing out for me in Ghost of Tsushima...
It may have been the leak. This may all
yeah,
like, come down to the leak of
the... But I think, like, Ghost of Tsushima looks gorgeous, but the fact that the lip-syncing only matches up to the American dub and not the Japanese dub is really sticking out for me, and just the AI sucks. Like, the enemies are just morons, and there's, like... a bit of a gap in between the animation quality. And I think that's the thing, like, for a lot of stuff in The Last of Us 2, it's fairly consistent. And like you said, it's just, you don't realize how much is really happening in there and, like, what level they've pushed it to until you go
the
back
fact
to something
that, like,
else.
And... There's never a single Uncanny Valley moment in that game in itself is staggering.
And all of the performances, like, you buy all of them.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think to me that just is... It's sort of like, it's one of those... The Witcher 3 did it as well. It was like a watershed moment for particular things in a video game. Like, it makes other developers sit up and take notice and sort of go... Like, for that game in particular, it was like, well, I guess we can't phone in our shitty side quests anymore. Naturally, that some...
But please give proper overtime to your staff and let them take holidays.
Yes. And that's the thing, like, you know, obviously the working conditions and other things, it's a big issue for a lot of people. And, you know, yes, we've got this fidelity and this quality, but at what cost to the people who made it? And it's not sustainable, and we need to really dial things back because there's a human cost to such things.
Well, just get better at managing studios. Like, you keep on hearing these stories about how, like, Insomniac, which is an ironic name for apparently, like, maybe the best-run studio in the sun. Like, how, like, they never crunch and, like, they actually get to work for, and it's, like, rated in, like, the top companies to work for in the US, period. Like, not just in games. And if they can do that and, like, have Spider-Man out and, like, have two friggin' PS5 games announced already.
But I think it's just that level of prestige. Like, Spider-Man was great, but it did not hit the heights of particular technical aspects of The Last of Us 2. And I think that's where we're starting to see that line. And the question for a lot of people is it worth the cost to have that, you know, those differentials?
Yeah.
But on a side note, though, like, when you're comparing games, like, when you compare, like, Spider-Man and The Last of Us 2, like, you know, you've got that huge open world that you've got to fill up with all these different activities and whatever, otherwise you've just got big empty space. With The Last of Us, it's just a very almost linear trek through, like, you know, as we said, you're just along for the ride, you know. So, like, yeah, well, it's got that huge, you know, step up in the graphical fidelity. They, you know, they've only got to focus on, you know, X amount of building the world, and everything else is just...
Actually, I would guess, if anything, that The Last of Us 2 would have to be more crafted.
Oh, would it?
I think in some ways it's apples and oranges, and I think in...
Yeah.
I think it'd be really hard to compare a couple of those things. I mean,
because in an open world game, how do you get around? You swing around, you drive a car around. Like, the traversal has to be very, very intentional in a more linear game. But we're getting off topic. I guess we've mostly touched on, is there anything in particular, Sean, you've been very quiet, that you were left with after?
Look, the one thing that did strike me when I was playing it, and I kind of wish that it had gone into a, you know, I suppose a little bit more, maybe not necessarily, like, minute detail, but just sort of the after effects. Like, with Lev, I mean, my takeaway was that that Lev was a trans person, and, like, I don't know, I guess, like, the things that occurred to me as we were playing and learning this information, I'm like, how does he then deal with that? I mean, like, you know, right now in this stage, we've got therapies, surgeries, and whatever, so that people can be who they are on the inside, on the outside. I'm probably not putting this in the best of ways, and I'm trying to...
Yeah, basically, Joel killed all the doctors, like, so that option isn't there anymore. It's
yeah, exactly. You know, so while Lev is living as a man, he's still going to develop as a woman, you know, throughout his life. And I don't know, it was just something that, you know... Like, Abby's just like, oh, yeah, okay, cool, and moved on. And, I mean, it could be the fact that, you know, she's never met a trans person like Lev before, but she didn't think, oh, you know, how's this going to affect this kid
growing up? I think when you're trying to not get eaten by zombies, maybe.
Yeah, there is that, but, you know.
And he was raised in a cult.
In the moments where they have this reflection and they're talking about their lives, like I said, like, it's just a little thing. It could just be me, you know, but that's just something that I would have maybe liked to have seen a bit more on, you know, not for, you know, any sort of virtue signaling or whatever the dickheads will call it or whatever, but just more genuine information on that kid's life. you know, and potentially what could happen after they go to Santa Barbara, you know.
Maybe we will get Last of Us 3 where you play as Lev.
Yeah, or some DLC.
My take on that thing is that throughout history, there have no doubt been people who are transgender. And they, up until very recently, were probably very limited in how they could express that or even transition to, as you said, how they felt on the inside, being able to present that on the outside. So I think it's just kind of touching on those aspects, like up until surgeries and hormone therapies and things were possible, how did these people deal with that? And I think it's, you know, probably that, you know, that kind of situation for Lev. Like, he obviously isn't able to do some of those things given the situation of the world, but I have to imagine that for, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years, there have been other people who have been in that same situation. And it's probably really only the last 50 to 100 years. With a whole bunch of
very dominant religious and cultural...
Realistically, probably the last 50 years that it has been, like, a reality for trans people to actually transition. So I think that was my take on that, like, and it, you know, sort of makes you realize like how small an amount of time these people have actually had with these options to be able to more fully explore who they are on the inside, and then if they so wish to make the transition so that they can outwardly present, or at least, you know, align their physiology with, you know, how they feel in terms of their gender identity.
Yeah.
And isn't this a fun topic for three straight white guys to be trying to figure out?
I think it's, you know, probably better than where we were before this game and not necessarily thinking about it as much.
Yeah. I just feel like there may be people other than us who are a bit more qualified to comment on what the theory is.
Absolutely, and I would cede the floor to them every time. But that's just been my thoughts on it, how I've engaged with that idea. And I think, again, that's, you know, maybe just some of the more underlying existential horror that this entire story brings to you, the more you sort of try to play out subsequent events and, you know, potential conclusions in the narrative or where it could go from there. Like, as you've said, if there's a Last of Us 3, are we going to be with Abby and Lev with the Catalina Fireflies? Is something going to pull Ellie out of Jackson once again? Like, where would they go with this story? Do you want to see a Last of Us 3? Like, is that something you absolutely need to have, or would you be happy if Last of Us Part 3 was never made?
I'd be happy if it was never made.
I'd be happy either way.
I think I feel the same way as I did after the first game. I don't need a sequel, but I trust in Naughty Dog enough that if they were going to make one, it's going to be for the right reasons.
I would like to see a third one, but I would also want them to be able to, like, put the franchise aside and start doing something different again. Perhaps something a little bit less depressing. Even Uncharted 4, while super high-hearted and jaunty compared to this, was also kind of dark by Uncharted standards.
I wonder if that was not, you know, born out of the fact that Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley
I'm sure it's born hugely out of that.
I guess, I mean, we all sound really positive on it, and I think it's my, like, for anyone who's on the fence or is maybe swayed by online opinion, I would really just push you to play it for yourself and experience it for yourself and make up your own mind on it.
If you've listened to this spoiler cast, then...
Yeah.
Yeah. If that's what it took to get you there.
Like, no, it was dark. It was a game that, you know, had me even sitting there just going, like, fuck, and just wanting to turn off at points. But for all of that, it was, like, you know, an awesome experience overall. Not one I'm about to do anytime soon, but, you know, it is something, you know, that is definitely worthwhile if you can invest the time into it.
And it is a long time. But it is ironic that we all got to play it during this, like, happy little bubble where both Australia and Japan, for us respectively, did not really have terribly out-of-control coronavirus situations.
At least not in Queensland.
Oh, well, still not in Queensland. It was basically just Melbourne at the moment. I'm just waiting for Sydney to fuck up.
Oh, it's coming. It's coming.
I feel like just Melbourne's gotten really unlucky. Like Sydney lets a plague ship loose and it still somehow keeps things under control.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to say we're probably done there. One thing, it is really fucking hot in this room. I would like to wrap this thing up. So
he wants to take his pants off and relax.
I just want to go to an air-conditioned room.
Who says that his pants are
Sean, have you got anything? That's true. You cannot see below my neckline. So, Sean, where can we find you? What do you have anything you want to pimp?
Nothing to pimp at the moment, unfortunately. But you can find me at on Twitter at SeanHubP2, or player2.net.au has all my writings and a couple of videos as well.
Alrighty, and Steve, thanks for making the time, putting your papers aside for a bit. Anything you would like to shout out to?
Hopefully I'll have a Catherine review up soon, and yeah, you can find me on player2.net.au and Gorath44000 on Twitter.
Yep, and I am at pretendbeard on Twitter, and on that note, I actually do need to shave
that
desperately
looks like a very
tomorrow
real
morning.
Beard.
It's filling in. I'm now also very confident. You know, like when you just become very conscious of it all of a sudden, it just feels way more prickly than it did like 10 seconds earlier. But I honestly
I'm at the point where my mustache.